Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello and welcome to Any Stupid Questions, the podcast where three comedians ask experts in important things, stuff you ought to know but don't. I'm Danielle Ward, and joining us to explain Israel and Palestine to us this week, yeah, good luck everyone, is Hugh Lovett, Policy Fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations, a pan-European think tank. Hello, Hugh.
Hiya.
Thanks for coming in. I mean, you know what? Let's just dig in. Let's just do it. What's the worst that can happen? Also joining me are comedy writer Jack Bernhard and comedy writer-producer Clarissa Maycock. Hello.
Hello.
Now, as we've realised, no one listens to the end of podcasts, so if you want to plug anything, you're going to have to do it right now. Jack.
I'm on Twitter, and so look at Twitter. It's a good website.
What is your Twitter handle? That's probably helpful.
At JackBurn23.
Larissa, have you got anything you'd like to plug?
Oh, I've also got a Twitter account. I'd love some followers.
What's your Twitter account?
It's at ClarissaDM.
Hugh, have you got anything you'd like to plug?
Also, you can see some of my work on the website of ECFR. We're doing a lot of work on Palestinian politics, which is quite cool. We have like this cool online platform, which you can check out.
Right, so Hugh, first question, and I think it's the one we're all thinking. Who has got the better food?
So that's the thing that gets me into the most trouble.
Is it? Well, then you sound like a lucky man.
Let me try to start neutral. Both sides has an amazing cuisine. Of course, Israeli food is very much informed by the vast Jewish diaspora that's out there. So you can go to Israel and you can eat all sorts of great food. One of my favorites is a shakshuka, which is kind of like this omelette that they sort of fry in tomato sauce and Tabasco and other things. But there's also, as with everything on this issue, it's controversial.
Really? What an omelette?
Food. Oh. And so my favourite food is it's called falafel, which is kind of like these sort of deep-fried chickpeas.
But we love
falafel.
We love it.
We know it.
We all know it's from that country.
Ah, exactly.
Okay.
So
it's right from Shepherd's Bush. No.
So everyone in the Middle East claims it. Palestinians claim it, Lebanese claim it, Syrians claim it, Egyptians claim it, and the Israelis claim it.
And this is where all the trouble starts.
Of course. But I'll go out on a limb and say my favourite falafel is definitely Palestinian from the West Bank.
Wow, well, already. We have to shut this down. Okay.
So I think if we can go in properly with our first question, my first question is, can you just tell us how did this start? What is the history of this situation?
So another controversial and difficult question to answer.
Oh, sorry. I think they're all
going to
be.
For. I mean, you could go back to the Bible. I think luckily for the audience, we're not going to do that because we'd be here for quite some time. But, you know, obviously that's how Israel and many people in Israel will legitimize Israel, is that we were here 2,000 years ago and we just came back after a small period of absence. But you could also go back to the late 19th century, which is what we saw as the birth of Zionism, which is basically the Jewish national movement, and that was in response to anti-Semitism in Europe. We could also go back to the early 20th century when you saw sort of the Zionist movement sending Jews from Europe to, at that time, what was called Palestine. So the Zionist vision was very much about, you know, trying to return to the land of Zion, trying to return to Israel. But the narrative at the time that was pushed forward, and this was also part of, you know, we were still in a very much European colonial perspective, and the idea was this is a people without a land for a land without a people. Mm-hmm. Of course, it wasn't that straightforward because there was a people there, which were Arabs and Palestinians. And inevitably, that created some friction. Fast forward to like 1917, where the British Empire in order to try to elicit support from Arab tribes that were fighting the Ottomans, who we were also fighting at that time, promised Palestine to them as part of this thing, the Trans-Arab Empire. But at the same time, and no one knew this, they also promised Palestine to the Zionist movement.
What, the British Empire did?
Yeah.
Oh, come on, back to those dicks.
Not knowing, what the left hand's doing. That's terrible. Yeah.
And there was, I'm sure we'll have a chance maybe to talk about anti-Semitism and how this is, but also part of the thing that was behind the British promise was also anti-Semitism, because British officials thought that Jews were all controlling, and that actually by promising the land of Israel to them, they would be able to gain Jewish influence over the American administration at the time and try to get the Americans to be more supportive of and to enter the First World War. Mm-hmm. And then fast forward now to the end of the First World War. During that time, Palestine became a mandate of Britain, that Britain realized it was too much to handle in terms of these two, this Jewish national movement, Zionism, versus the Palestinian national movement. So it basically pushed off everything to the UN, which, broadly speaking, agreed to partition the land. That didn't go down too well, so we had our first war. Israel won. Israel was created. Mm-hmm. We had a few more wars, and then fast forward to 1967. So this was by now the third Arab-Israeli war. Israel again won, and they took over what's called the West Bank, East Jerusalem, which is very important to Jews because this is, their holiest place. And they also took over Gaza. And so this is in 1967. This is the start of what we now refer to as the occupation, which is the occupation of Palestinian territory. Mm-hmm. And so when we talk about two-state solution, this is what we're basically referring to as kind of the occupation that started in 1967, because we now as international community recognize Israel's right to exist within the borders that existed before 67. So that's very long and complicated, but that's basically the essence of it.
No, I mean, that is a good answer. Thank you.
No laughs yet.
Yeah. Oh, gosh, it's just hard to know what to...
I feel dreadful because I don't know so little about the issue. I know hardly anything, and hearing you talk about it makes me realise I know even less than I thought. I was thinking, do you know if there's ever been another sort of situation, a similar comparable situation in history anywhere else? Or is this such a unique set of circumstances? Do you know if there's anything in history that's been similar?
Yeah, for sure. And I think what's interesting before I answer that is that you have both people who are supporters of the Palestinian cause, but also who will say, this is a unique situation. Mm-hmm. We've never seen anything like this. And then conversely, you have people, supporters of the Israeli government and the settler movement, who say, hang on, how come you're singling us out? Mm-hmm. And if you're singling us out and making unfair criticism, a criticism that you're not leveling against Syria or, Scotland's occupied, sometimes you hear them say, why aren't you going after the UK and others?
Yeah.
And, and the Israeli government basically says, and this is now a definition that's been adopted in some parliaments, which is a definition of anti-Semitism, which is basically unfairly singling out Israel when you don't do that vis-a-vis other conflicts and situations. So to answer your question, as with everything, I think the truth is somewhere in between. In the eyes of international law, at a minimum, the Palestinian territories, the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and still Gaza, is considered to be occupied territory. And there actually aren't that many other territories that are considered to be occupied according to international law. It's a bit debatable, but you could put Western Sahara in it, which has been occupied, annexed by Morocco. So this is probably the bit now that will get everyone in trouble with a lot of Moroccans listening to this who would argue that actually, no, that's not the case.
Yeah.
But international law, that's how the Western Sahara is seen.
Is Gibraltar occupied?
Not under, according to international law.
Just asking.
But I was thinking, is it perhaps unique in terms of how significant the area is in religious texts, maybe? I don't know.
So I think it's, I think, as I said, there's a few territories that are occupied, Crimea, which Russia annexed. But I think there are nonetheless a few particularities that do make the Palestinian situation, I think, a bit more acute in terms of what's happening. These other territories do have a degree of settlement activity. I would argue that what is happening in the Palestinian territories is, I think, probably on a far grander scale in terms of numbers and government activities and energies that's going into this. But I think another reason that I think that makes the Palestinian situation stand out a bit more is, of course, our own complicity in this. I mean, our own relations, not just with Israel, which I would argue are completely legitimate, but it's also our relations with the settlements. There is European financial support, whether direct or indirect, for these settlements. And we have a long history of trying to advance peace and failing. And so I think there's a few things that mean that we are much more involved in this, and that what happens there does affect us, rightly or wrongly, but it does affect us far more on a day-to-day basis. And, you know, we're having this podcast about the Palestinian issue. We put on the TV and you're more likely to see something about that than you are about Western Sahara or somewhere else. And so there is also, I think, this sort of a long-running narrative that has existed in our society about the Palestinian struggle.
What's the difference between Hezbollah and Hamas and Fatah and the PLO and the Palestinian Authority?
So Hamas, Hezbollah, one is Palestinian and the other is Lebanese. But they are often sort of conflated together because they're both, I would say, parties that promote political Islam, even though Hamas is Sunni and Hezbollah is Shiite.
Not that old thing again.
That old thing. But they're also, to varying degrees, supported by Iran. But I see them, nonetheless, you know, as I said, one's Lebanese, one's Palestinian. They think they're affected by different dynamics. And Hamas is mostly in Gaza at the moment. In terms of, and then Fatah is sort of the other dominant party within Palestinian politics. It's the party of the current president, Mahmoud Abbas, and was the party of Yasser Arafat, who some people may have heard of before. And it's been the sort of the one of the parties that's been the historically the most associated with sort of the secular left resistance to Palestine, or the struggle against Palestine. And then the PLO is basically this umbrella organization which brings together basically all of the sort of the left-wing or secular groups. But Hamas is not a member. If I take this opportunity to plug some of my work, so there is actually, we have this thing ECFR's put together called Mapping Palestinian Politics, which has like all this information explained much better than I ever could.
Right, I'm going to ask a question that I think is going to get cut. And which of those are terrorists?
It's a good question. I think that's an important point. And I think it does also show how our view and engagement with parties changes over the years. So Fatah, which is now, you know, very much mainstreamed in terms of European recognition and engagement, and is the party of the president for at least, I think, 2 decades since it was founded in the 60s up until the 80s. Europe and the US considered it to be a terrorist organization, and Yasser Arafat, its head, to be a terrorist organization, and so too the PLO. And then there was, during the 80s, because there's a recognition that you need basically the PLO to be involved in peace with Israel, there was a process of trying to bring the PLO in from the cold. And they did that by basically getting the PLO to recognize Israel and commit to a two-state solution. Hamas is still considered to be a terrorist organization. However, you know, I think if you read history books about how Europe and the US approached the PLO and the issues with the PLO at the time, and if you look at what's happening with Hamas at the moment, I think there's certainly some parallels, even though obviously there's many differences in a different context. But I think with Hamas also, there is sort of debate about, you know, our policy of trying to boycott it, sanction it, is not working. I think there's also recognition that there's far, far, far worse groups in Gaza than Hamas. And Hamas, I think it's important to say, is not Al-Qaeda. Like, neither group is particularly nice. But I think there is a world of difference in terms of the ideology and what they want to do. And I think Hamas, to a certain extent, does want to reach out to the international community and legitimize itself. So I think the question is, you know, whether Hamas could ever do enough in terms of moderation for there to be a degree of official engagement between Europe and it. And going back to the question about, you know, are there lessons for Northern Ireland?
Yeah.
I think absolutely. In terms of, you know, how we saw some of the groups there, you know, officially calling them terrorists, but then slowly opening back channels. So, you know, I don't think we're quite there yet with Hamas, but maybe that's something relevant to dwell upon at some point.
Most people living in, like, the West Bank who would consider themselves Israeli, what do they think about all of this? How do they perceive it?
Israeli settlers are not that happy, by and large. There is obviously, I think there's a component of the Israeli settler population which is there for probably more economic reasons, because the Israeli government has actually put in place a number of incentives to actually attract people towards the settlements, like economic benefits, I think in some cases tax breaks, etc.
I was going to say, why would you move there?
Better quality of life, you pay less. They've also connected the settlements to Tel Aviv, and so, you know, it's like almost like a suburban commuter belt. But you obviously also have then a more hardcore religious ideology, national religious or national component that's there for, as I said, for religious or national reasons.
Yeah.
But clearly when they want to interact with us in Europe and the settlements become an issue in these relations, then, yeah, then this causes problems.
So, because in the current times, there's a lot talked about how Britain is divided and there's so much division in Britain about Europe. And I guess...
We have it easy compared to what's going on there.
But is there a similar kind of division among...
So there's plenty of, I think, fissures or divisions within Israeli society, but they generally extend first and foremost to other issues in terms of religious and personal issues. So, for example, during Shabbat, which is Friday sunset to Saturday sunset, religious Jews don't work, don't travel, etc. There's obviously a large component of Israeli Jewish society that's secular.
Yes.
But there may be no bus services where they live because it's Shabbat. Some, you know, shops may be closed because it's Shabbat. And so this is like, you know, a big point of discussion within society, within Israeli society. So I'd say that's the one of the bigger issues. But of course, there is the issue about occupation and how they relate to Palestinians, which perhaps was more prescient maybe 10, 15 years ago. But I think so it's now less of a priority, but it's still there. About, you know, does one annex all the Palestinians? Should we separate from them, etc.? And so no, it's there. But I think we have seen, I think, the issue of Palestinian statehood, the two-state solution, being less present within general day-to-day Israeli discourse.
Is it possible to be Israeli and not Jewish, if that makes sense?
Actually, there's no such thing as Israeli nationality.
Okay.
So Israelis have ID cards.
Mm-hmm.
And what's written there is you're either Jewish or Arab. It has, that's how it designates you. So there is a sizable minority of Israel's population that is not Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
And that probably refers to itself as Palestinian, you know. But then there's other components which would more refer to themselves as Arab, so they would downplay the Palestinian national identity side. And I think we've seen a process since Israel's founding where there's been these policies in place which try to dilute the Palestinian national identity of those Palestinians, Arabs, that stayed in Israel after the 1948 war. And in order to try to integrate them into Israeli society. So the idea is we recognize you as individuals, not necessarily always as minorities with collective rights and national rights. So yes, to answer your question, there are non-Jews in Israel, but, you know, some, especially, you know, the community that refers to itself as Palestinian, Palestinian Arab, frequently talks about, you know, day-to-day discrimination.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of legislation, it's less apparent. On paper, they're mostly equal, although there's been a move over the last year to actually put, you could argue, Jews above everyone else. This is a very, very controversial law called the nation-state law. But certainly in day-to-day practice, there's that discrimination. So it's a work in progress, I think.
So if a baby is born in the West Bank, what passport do they have?
This is actually one of my favourite questions. Oh. But it's probably more about how geeky I am. If the baby is Israeli, from Israeli parents, born in an Israeli settlement, so the settlements are Israeli towns, villages, outposts that have been built illegally, according to international law, in occupied Palestinian territory in East Jerusalem, the West Bank now. So if a baby is born in one of those settlements, they are Israeli. You know, they'll have an Israeli passport and they'll be treated basically no different from someone born in Tel Aviv.
Yeah.
However, in our eyes, in the eyes of Europeans and the international community, we see that differently.
Okay.
And so the problem is if you have, say, a British national who happens to live in a settlement and he applies for a British passport, what do we put in the passport? And so the usual practice is if he's born in Jerusalem, it is not to put Jerusalem Israel.
Yeah.
It is merely to put Jerusalem in it because we don't recognize Israeli sovereignty over East Jerusalem and nor really over Jerusalem. But that's a more complicated reason that called the corpus separatum, which we won't get into at the moment. Basically, Europe, you know, has a duty to differentiate between Israel and the settlements and the occupied territories, because, you know, we have to uphold our own policies, our own positions and international law.
Yeah.
But as you can imagine, sometimes that creates a bit of a friction with our Israeli friends.
So what you're saying is don't have a baby in West Bank.
But it extends to everything. You had a guest before who was talking about, you know, a farmer talking about chickens. And,
yeah.
And, you know, we import stuff from Israel.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But we're not able to import poultry products from the settlements, because we cannot recognise Israeli veterinary checks in the settlements.
Oh,
I'll give you a second to digest that.
So, talking about the two-state solution, what are the objections to that and where do they come from?
Palestinians are probably, one could say, by and large, the most supportive of it now. The two-state solution is relatively new because, as I said, although the occupation started in 1967, for quite some time, the Palestinian national movement still wanted to reclaim all of Palestine. So it wanted the West Bank, East Jerusalem, Gaza, but also what is now present-day Israel, because it didn't want to partition.
Yeah.
But through intensive international diplomatic efforts, not to get into details, but basically starting in the late 70s, 80s, the PLO, which is the main representative of the Palestinians, accepted a two-state solution, which Palestinians would say is a compromise on mm-hmm. their part. Now, I think for Israel, it's a bit more difficult. You have a strand within Israeli politics and society that's much more maximalistic in its demands mm-hmm. and much more ideological. And, you know, that strand of politics and society is in power at the moment. And they basically want all of the land because, you know, the West Bank is referred to as Judea and Samaria.
Yeah.
And it's particularly important to the Jewish national movement because that is kind of, when you read the Bible, that is where a lot of the Bible took place. And so they have an ideological claim to it in their eyes. And so that strand of Israeli politics and society has been much more resistant mm-hmm. to compromise. They have, to a certain extent, moved towards compromise, and the centre-left Labour Party also, but usually under pressure from the US and sometimes from Europe to do this. But in my view, it's questionable whether they've ever fully been able to go far enough to meet Palestinian demands and whether the Palestinians have been able to concede enough mm-hmm. to meet Israeli demands. So we are where we are today, basically, which is with this idea of a two-state solution receding from the horizon.
So where do the Israeli government at the moment, where do they want the Palestinians to go if they take this land?
There's different theories, even on the right, about how you deal with this.
Yeah.
And in many ways, those ideas have been around since the 70s, since the two-state solution started being pushed. And so basically, my take on right-wing Israeli politics is, I think where we are now is probably the center of gravity doesn't want an independent, sovereign Palestinian state, you know, with borders and real sovereignty.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, I think there's a recognition they cannot absorb all the Palestinian population. Mm-hmm. Because basically, you know, Israel, you could say, in right-wing vision, has three components, three characteristics. So democratic, Jewish, and has the territory.
Yeah.
But actually, you can't have all three things. Mm-hmm. You can have the territory and be Jewish, but you're not democratic, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
So if you were to absorb millions of Palestinians, it creates a demographic imbalance, which therefore jeopardizes Jewish character and democracy. And so the question mark for decades, in my view, has always been, you know, how you square that circle. Mm-hmm. And what we've seen from the 70s onwards, starting, you know, with Begin, who's the Israeli prime minister, and others, and these are right-wing prime ministers, although the talking points, I think, have been adopted by the center-left now, but it's to try to create a sense of Palestinian autonomy and self-rule. But it's this idea that, you know, we try to cater to your economic needs, to a certain degree your political needs, but you can't have full sovereignty. You remain under Israeli control.
Okay.
And I think that's where the center of gravity is. You know, of course, you have those who are more idealistic on the left and the right that would go for a full one state, perhaps with equal, a certain degree of equal rights.
Yeah.
But I don't think that's where the right is at the moment, it's the right which is very much in power within Israel.
If you're enjoying Any Stupid Questions, why not rate and review? Wait till it's finished. Don't just stop halfway, because that also affects our advertising, I think. But when you get to the end of the podcast, rate and review it. Thank you very much.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more.
That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Can I ask about anti-Semitism? Mm-hmm. Europe has this horrible history of anti-Semitism, and that seems to be on the rise. Why is that happening?
I think on the left, of course, it's always been around, unfortunately. And it's always been around on the right. Perhaps the drivers of this anti-Semitism is a bit different on the left, because maybe it's born more out of anti-imperialism, anti-colonialism. Perhaps on the right, it's much more driven by fascism, neo-Nazism, etc.
God, you can't win being Jewish, can you?
And I think there's also this this deliberate campaign that's been pushed by the Israeli government and organisations that promote and defend the settler movement to try to broaden the definition of anti-Semitism. And so I think this now, and I think this is also why a lot of people get into trouble, because there's a bit of a grey zone between things that are obviously outright anti-Semitic and then this criticism of Israel that everyone says is legitimate.
Yeah.
And I think you see both sides like trying to, it's this tug of war, trying to redefine what is acceptable, what is not acceptable. And we've seen this, you know, in the case of US Congressman Ilhan Omar. She put out a tweet a few days ago, which said, what was it, like, oh, it's all about
the Benjamins, I think.
The Benjamins, which is obviously a reference to US dollar bills.
Yeah.
And that was in reference to a story about sort of the pro-Israel lobby in the US. And so you could read her tweet two ways. One is that she was attacking the money that's inherent in the US lobby. But the way she framed it, it obviously plays to a lot of traditional anti-Semitic tropes, this idea of, you know, the Jews controlling the world with lots of money. And certainly I think the way she framed the tweet was it the most articulate way.
Because what's quite fascinating is if, like, and not everybody agrees with this, but as a white person, it is not my place to decide what is racist. Mm. It isn't. Like, I don't believe that. I take my guidance from people of colour. But with anti-Semitism, again, I don't believe it's my place to decide what anti-Semitism is. That is a Jewish person's decision, or, you know, collectively. But that doesn't seem to be the case. A lot of people who aren't Jewish seem to want to decide what anti-Semitism is, in the way that, you know, white people would never decide what racism is. And again, I'm confused as to why that is the case.
And I think this is what makes it very difficult for everyone. And I think certainly the only, and the best starting point is, of course, you know, how Jews feel about this.
Yeah.
But I think what makes this very difficult is that Israel itself defines itself as a Jewish state.
Yeah. Mm.
So when you criticize Israel, you know, this comes with,
I understand.
This can be easily misconstrued by either side as also being criticism against the Jewish people. And we're also dealing with a conflict between two national movements. And so I think this is perhaps another source of contestation. But also I would say is, I think what makes it more difficult is because it's also, you know, by expanding what anti-Semitism is, which is now often taken to be unjust criticism of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
Even now, you know, anti-Zionism is often seen as anti-Semitism, which perhaps would have been the case 10, 20 years ago.
Yeah.
But what this is also doing is it's shrinking the space for Palestinians to push back, and for people who support the Palestinians to push back. And again, I feel the need to say, you know, obviously there's no justification for anti-Semitism. But I think, you know, what is and what is not anti-Semitism is still, in some cases, contentious.
Are there people, left-wing people in Israel who are fighting against Netanyahu, and is it likely that at any point they will come into power and try to decolonize and we can all
live in peace?
Live in Kumbaya. Peace, yeah. Is that going to happen?
No. Okay. I mean, maybe one day, but I would say, like, the left in Israel is having a particularly bad moment.
Okay.
And the Israeli Labour Party is also having a very bad moment.
In what way?
So, in terms of, so there'll be elections in Israel in April. The Labour Party is currently, it's in the opposition, mm-hmm. but it's a sizable party. I forget the exact number of MPs it has, but I think it's about 24 or something. According to current polls, it's probably, if elections were held today, they'd probably have about 6.
Oh, no, they're the Lib Dems of Israel.
Did they promise something to do with student loans?
I think the lesson is don't try to emulate the right when you're not the right.
Oh, is that what it is?
That's what they've been trying.
They're losing... They'll lose seats because they've tried to follow the right.
Yeah, yeah.
That's really fascinating.
And the current head of the Labour Party was himself a former member of Likud, which is a right-wing party.
Oh, God.
But I don't feel too bad because I would argue, and this will probably be the another thing that will get me in trouble, is, you know, I don't even view the Israeli Labour Party as left anymore.
Yeah.
Mm. I would say it's centre-left.
But maybe that's an optimistic thing. If people aren't voting for them because they've gone too right, that means that there is an appetite for a genuine left-wing Labour Party in Israel.
Or you could just vote for the real thing and vote for the right.
Oh, okay. So there isn't a big group of people who are like, stop decolonisation, stop...
No, stop
colonisation.
I think the centre of gravity in Israel is centre-right, right.
Okay.
And, you know, before the Labour Party always modelled itself as the peace camp and, you know, and talked a lot about ending the occupation, etc. But that's not really part of their discourse anymore. And when they do talk about it, it's not about ending the occupation. It's about what they call is basically separation. But it's still with an overarching Israeli security control over the Palestinians, which I would argue is not real deoccupation.
Yeah.
And so the left, sort of the proper left in Israel is called Meretz, and that similarly normally has about 5 MPs every election. And then you have the Arab-Israeli or Palestinian-Israeli groups, which are there and exist, and together they're probably about 13 seats, although they're also having a bit of a moment.
Oh.
So I've never been accused of leaving people with a hopeful message.
When someone like Tony Blair is made a Middle East peace envoy, what does a peace envoy do? And does it help to have people as peace envoy? I'm just trying to imagine a day in the life, you know.
The Good Friday Agreement. I mean, he's got previous.
That was good.
Yeah.
I just trying to imagine, like, the average day. Like, you do a few emails.
Oh, what you get up to as a peace
envoy.
Yeah,
yeah. Have some coffee. I don't know. How do you literally go about peace? I don't know.
Well, mercifully, he's no longer peace envoy. No.
I remember when he was Torso of the Week in Heat magazine. So,
was that before or after the Good Friday Agreement?
That was before the Good Friday Agreement.
Oh, wow. So, if anything, that torso just got hotter.
The diplomatic influences in Palestine and Israel, do they ever look at the Good Friday Agreement? Is that ever considered a benchmark for peace?
So, there is a branch of expertise on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict that has looked at the Irish conflict and what's been happening in Northern Ireland. So yeah, I think that's obviously taken into account, and there are, especially in terms of how that informs civil society, people-to-people initiatives. Mm-hmm. I'm somewhat more sceptical of this. Not that there's not things to learn about the Good Friday Agreement, but I think in Northern Ireland, we'd reached a point where both sides kind of realised they needed to move forward and try to figure it out. And I don't see... On the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, I don't see us in that position at the moment, where those lessons would be currently relevant. I think we're much more about how you can actually, on the Israeli side, change the cost-benefit calculations to actually encourage Israelis to view deoccupation as a more favourable outcome than continued occupation.
And I suppose in the Good Friday Agreement, Tony Blair was at least he was on one side of it. rather than sort of coming from the outside? I just wonder about how sometimes high-profile sort of peacemakers coming from the outside.
Yeah, everybody's had a stab at it, haven't they?
And, and how you even go about it. I mean, it must be really tough to sort of start.
Yeah, I know, that would be, oh, no, not this. when America and Cuba were in conflict, they got the Pope involved because both sides trusted him. Who's the equivalent for Palestine and Israel?
So I don't think we have that equivalent at the moment.
Batman, sorry.
For the last 20 years, it's the US that's been the main mediator of peace.
Oh, no.
Well, yeah, and that's probably what the Palestinians are saying now. I think on the Palestinian side, there was always a realization that the Americans were never completely neutral or honest in brokering peace agreements. But still, they were reasonably or relatively objective.
Yeah.
I think that's no longer the view on the Palestinian side because the Trump administration has been taking a number of particularly egregious actions against the Palestinians, basically recognizing Jerusalem as Israel's capital.
Yeah.
And also cutting money to the Palestinians and Palestinian refugees, etc. So that's discredited the Americans in the eyes of the Palestinians.
Mm-hmm.
And the Palestinians would be much more happy if, say, Europe, the European Union, or even Russia or someone else, anyone else.
Yeah, could literally mediator, anybody else.
Literally anyone else. But of course, Israel would not agree to this.
Why does the recognition of Jerusalem as the Israeli capital matter?
So, good question. And I think this is the one where I tend to be more in the minority when I talk to with European officials or other European think tankers. So at the moment, there's and I may have mentioned this before, corpus separatum, which basically means we don't recognize any side's sovereignty over Jerusalem, either West or East.
Mm-hmm.
And this policy has been in place since basically 1948. And then in 1967, you know, East Jerusalem was occupied by Israel. And then in the 80s, it was legally annexed. Now, in my view, there's this difference between the corpus separatum and how international law views the occupation. So my own position, for what it's worth, which is nothing, is that, you know, I don't think it's a big deal if we recognize West Jerusalem as Israel's capital, so long as we recognize East Jerusalem as Palestine's capital, even if it's still under occupation. But since, mercifully for everyone, I don't make European policy, you know, European states, the UK, up until recently the US, and basically every other country still upholds this corpus separatum idea that the future status of Jerusalem has to be negotiated during what's called final status negotiations. And so this is why I think a lot of people get quite anxious or got quite anxious when the US recognized Jerusalem.
Jack.
The way it's often framed in the sort of the justification of the Israeli actions is that Palestine and other Arabic countries want to destroy Israel. Is that sort of, I mean, that's unique to this situation, and how true is that? And is that sort of part of the reason that this is such a mess, is that it's about, like if they can actually exist, or, like, fundamentally?
And can I chip in what might be a stupid question on top of that? Do they want Israel to not exist at all, or they just want to shift it along a bit?
So, you know, the Israeli narrative has very much been, you know, Israel confronting Arab armies, aggressive Arab neighbours. And for a large part of Israel's history, that's, I think, entirely true and accurate. And Israel's done a very good job of pushing back and winning.
Yeah.
But I think now, I don't actually think that's the situation. I mean, in terms of Israeli-Arab conflict, which we used to talk about, I don't think that's the case. Certainly there's an Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
Mm-hmm.
But I think in terms of other Arab states, Jordan, Egypt now have a peace treaty.
Mm-hmm.
But even states that don't have a peace treaty, and I suppose are technically still at war with Israel, are actually now increasingly moving to normalize their relations. And this is particularly true for Gulf states. So we had the Israeli prime minister who made quite a remarkable trip to Oman a few months back and shook the hand of the Omani sultan. Mm-hmm. We've had Israeli ministers visiting the United Arab Emirates openly, publicly. And we've known that these relations have existed for years now at the security level particularly. But we are seeing this normalization coming out into public, out of the closet. And I think what this does indicate is that I think that there's a new sort of geopolitical alignment that's forming in the Middle East, mainly as a way, I think, in the eyes of its Arab leaders to try to push back against Iranian influence, which they see far more as something that's far more pressing and important than the Palestinian issue. But I think the question now is, can Israel advance peace with its Arab neighbours without resolving the Palestinian issue?
And has any of this to do with nuclear weapons in terms of Iran being the threat and Israel being an ally?
When you listen to Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, other Israeli politicians and members of the security establishment, they tend to put the Iranian issue as sort of number one in terms of existential threats.
Yeah.
To open a parenthesis, it's quite interesting that you do have former members or heads of the Mossad, which is basically the Israeli equivalent of MI6, saying actually the most existential question is actually the Palestinian issue. Okay, closing the parenthesis. But I think that is still the, when you listen to Israeli discourse, Iran is seen as a big threat. And so Israeli leaders have tried to forge alliances with these Arab states and also encourage the American administration to be much more confrontational in order to try to push back Iranian activities in Syria, Lebanon, and elsewhere.
We've got time for one more question each, one quick question.
Oh, goody.
They're having too much fun.
I was just going to say, you mentioned in your overview of the history, the British Empire. Mm-hmm. I remember those guys. They've turned up as the villain in other things as well. But is there like anti-British feeling in the area?
The advantage that Britain has at the moment is Palestinians and other people in the Middle East have far stronger feelings against other countries than the UK at the moment.
Oh, that's good.
You're down the league table. Yeah. It's good.
So, no, I don't think there's a strong anti-British sentiment in the Palestinian territories. There may be a strong anti-British sentiment in Iraq and other places for other reasons, which we won't go into. Right. But no, I don't think, I think if anything, there is a strong feeling of friendship towards Europeans because Europe is seen as more supportive of Palestinian rights. But I think there's still a desire, if you ask Palestinians, for the UK to actually fulfill its what's called the Balfour Declaration, which was basically Britain saying, we recognise the rights of the Jewish people to have a homeland at that time in Israel, or a mandate Palestine, as it was called. But it also had a second part, which is basically nothing should be done to prejudice the rights of the original Arab inhabitants. Arguably, that second part hasn't really been fulfilled. And so I think if you ask Palestinians, that's probably the thing they'll mention to you.
Jack, have you got a funny question?
Best case scenario in 5 years' time, where are we? Is it good? Please say it's good.
You're challenging me to try to come up with an optimistic scenario
in
my head.
It's got to be good. There can be nothing bad.
It's difficult to see things getting vastly better. Okay. I think if you ask, say, some European governments, their probably optimistic scenario is nothing's changed.
Wow.
So we're not really sort of pushing things forward, but at least things haven't regressed. I personally think things are going to get much worse because I'm just probably an eternal glass half empty person. But I think if one wanted to fast forward it a bit more, I think there's always a question about, you know, on the Palestinian side, which is having going through a profound moment of historical weakness in terms of strategy, the identity of the national liberation movement, other components. I think you kind of have to believe at some point they'll get through that. Maybe not in 5 years, but you know, there is when you talk to you know, young Palestinians, I think that is a source of a lot of optimism in terms of how they will view and how they will approach the conflict going forward and in ways that completely discredit violence, that embrace nonviolent resistance, but look at some, you know, perhaps innovative, disruptive strategies based on rights and equal rights. I think that could be a sort of an interesting scenario. And, you know, there's part of this young generation that's progressive, you know, into dance music, rap, hip hop, underground music that has a lot in common. Can I say hipster? Like, basically, the hipsters of Tel Aviv. And so, you know, I think there is, even if they're not interacting at the moment, there is, I think, a degree of potential intersectionality between young Israelis and young Palestinians. So that would be my attempt at grasping at something positive.
So, like, in 10 years' time, they may be like, oh, I like Kendrick Lamar too. And
then I won't comment on Kendrick Lamar, but...
Okay.
So I have one final question. Do you think the conflict would be made a lot worse or a lot better by allowing Palestine to enter the Eurovision Song Contest?
Obviously much better.
Much better. Oh, and no one's thought of it. I mean, I'm full of all the good ideas. Thank you so much, Hugh. That was, like, not as terrifying as I thought it was going to be. Well, I think that's it for this week. Thanks to Hugh Lovett, Jack Bernhard and Clarissa Makeup. That was the last Any Stupid Questions of Series 3. We'll be back at some point with a fourth series, but if you have any subjects you want us to cover, whether it's the royal family, China or the music industry, tweet us and we will try and find an expert for you. Thank you so much for listening, and please do rate and review and tell your friends. I've been Danielle Ward and the producer was Ed Morris. Cheers.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.